Hello, welcome to Tales from the Periphery, episode 11, with me, your host, Mike Woody. So most of this show is going to be an interview with my guest, but just before we do that, a little update on some upcoming events. Week on Saturday, which is to say the 25th, we have a couple of things going on. If you are in the vicinity of Enfield, then my previous guests Sam and Rich Shadowblade are running Operation Dragon Slayer, as Bob and I mentioned last episode, at Ponders End United Reformed Church. This is a massive Alpha Strike battle featuring the Battle for Luthien. Come as Clan Smoke Jaguar, Clan Nova Cat, or Dragonis Combine, Kellhounds, or Wolf Dragoon forces, and you can take part in the defence or attack on, depending on how you look at it, of Luthien. On the same day, the good folks at Board in Brum are running a Battletech Introduction Day. This is Lewis and the guys at Board in Brum. It is an all-day event starting at 10:30. They'll be running both Alpha Strike and Classic Battletech as running some casual play games. If you want to come along and bring a force, 4,000 BV of Classic or 200 points of Alpha Strike, or just come along and there will be mechs you can get your hands on. Also coming up on the 12th of April is Salute, which is the UK's biggest wargame show at the Exhale Centre in London. Stuart, who's also been a guest of the podcast, and I, and probably some folks from both our organisations, will be there. We're on a bunch of tables which are a couple of aisles apart, but Stuart is basically running some Battletech demo stuff, and I will be running some Alpha Strike demo stuff. So pop along, say hi. If you're lucky, I may have some podcast dice to give away, and it will be great to see you there. Another show from last year, which put in an appearance, is the Bedford Tabletop Expo. This is going to be held at the International Athletic Stadium in Bedford on March the 8th and 9th. Again, I and the Peterborough guys are expecting to be there with some Battletech. We'll be bringing some Alpha Strike. Someone else may come along and bring some Classic. Watch this space for more. As ever, you can find all the details of these on talesfromtheperiphery.org.uk. Look in the right-hand sidebar for the events diary. If you've got any more events for me or new entries for the clubs and stores directory, then you can let me know via the usual contacts, which is to say Fleetfoot Mike on the Discord or info@talesfromtheperiphery.org.uk. As I quite often say on this podcast, I have a guest. This time it is award-winning author Brian Young.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Welcome aboard. We have, I think, the important thing to discuss at some point down the line is Voidbreaker, which is coming out as we record next week, but I suspect at the time this comes out, very, very soon indeed. But I have a tradition with my first-time guests that we have a little selection of questions that you have to answer so folks can get to know you. Starting with, how did you get into gaming writing and Battletech?
Gaming writing and Battletech, those are three very different questions.
I know.
So gaming was just something that, getting into gaming, that just seems like, I really don't remember. It just seems like gaming was there. I think the first time I had siblings that were smaller than me, and it was just something we did, right? I remember getting, I was maybe 7 or 8 when the West End D6 Star Wars role-playing game came out. Yeah, I remember having that and sort of trying to play that with my siblings as 7 or 8. Like, we were role-playing very young, and we had Nintendos and Super Nintendos and stuff, and so gaming was always around, and my uncle, who always felt more like a cousin because he was only a few years older than me, dropped off at our house when we were very young sort of a box of role-playing books, and in that box was a whole bunch of Dungeons and Dragons and Shadowrun and Battletech and all kinds of stuff. And so in that box, I had like that original Shrapnel collection and a couple of the rule books and stuff. Not enough to play, but enough to sort of be fascinated by the mechs and whatnot. So that was sort of my first glimpse at the world, but not really stepping into it until the Super Nintendo game, MechWarrior, maybe 93 or so. And I played the hell out of that game. And that was actually my first introduction to Battletech. And then I played lots of the MechWarrior games over the years. You know, in the 90s, I had a friend who had like 8 networked machines in his basement because his parents had like a business in their basement. And after hours, we could go down and play. And so we would play MechWarrior among other games down there. And that was a lot of fun. But I didn't get into the tabletop until I started writing Battletech, actually. As far as writing...
Yeah, Battletech is not your first writing rodeo, is it?
No, as far as writing was something that I was doing. I was really fascinated in from a young age. Like, I won my first creative writing award in the 4th grade.
Translate that for my English listeners.
I was probably, well, my son right now is in 4th grade, so I was 8 or 9 years old.
Right, so that's about year 3, year 4 for us. So I think they match.
Yeah. And I never really looked back. So I was always interested in being a writer and always interested in writing fiction. I've done a lot of filmmaking and filmmaking was something that I still do some of and still do a lot of, but it's expensive and you need to coerce a lot of people to help you do it. And it's much more collaborative, because you need so many more people and so much more money. So writing was something that I could do. Writing fiction was something that I could do on my own. And so, you know, I was always doing that on the side. And it was actually Mike Stackpole who sort of pushed me to publish my first novel on my own in 2011. And I did a bunch of sort of indie publishing after that with small presses. And really worked to get into more professional publishing after that. I mean, the small presses were great, but I really kind of felt like I'd hit a glass ceiling with audience. And worked on getting an agent and then getting into some more professional stuff. And while I was doing that, I was publishing short stories all over the place. And then had come in contact with John Helfers and the folks at Battletech, and they were really starting their fiction line back up. And Mike had suggested that I come in and do that. And originally he and I were going to co-write some Kellhounds, a trilogy of Kellhound stuff. This was maybe 2017, 2018. And there was a lot of stuff that I'd pitched before they ultimately decided we were going to start heading into the IllClan era. And so everything that I had pitched and everything that Mike and I had developed got scrapped and we started heading in a different direction.
Oh boy, that almost rings bells. Many, many years ago, when I was playing Battletech, about the time that you were in 4th grade, I think, we actually pitched a novel to Faza, based on the goings on with the 12th Legion Rangers in old Kentucky, to discover that they were actually planning 10, 15 years ahead of the timeline at that point. And they said, "Very nice outline, sorry." So I, on a lesser scale, I get that feeling. Now, let's do the quick fire round, because that's always good for a laugh. Classic Battletech or Alpha Strike?
I prefer classic. I like Alpha Strike just fine, and sometimes it just depends on what I'm doing. If I'm running like a role-playing game, it depends on the situation. I really love mixing the role-playing game with both of them. Right. So it depends on the scale. If the players are doing something where they're controlling large groups of people and commanding a huge battle, Alpha Strike, because otherwise we'll never leave. you know, but if it's something where they're in their personal mechs and it's just them operating their one character, definitely classic. But if it's just me playing by myself with a few other people, definitely classic.
Yeah, as I think I've put it to folks, if you want, if you're doing Fox Patrol, you want classic. If you're doing the full-on Stackpole, you need Alpha Strike.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Toys on the table, painted or not?
You know, I would have said a year ago, it doesn't matter. Well, I mean, it still doesn't matter, but I was fine without painted, but I really got the painting bug in the last year, actually. Last year at Adepticon, Catalyst had me out as a guest for the 40th anniversary of Battletech, and they had
the Alpha Strike betrayal, among other things.
Yes, the infamous Alpha Strike betrayal. I'm surprised by how well that story's traveled.
it turns up on Google, I think, if you search for that or something very close to it.
They actually had Mike Stackpole and I. They filmed a video of it. I don't think the video ever came out, but he and I, they put us in a class together painting our first mechs, and we painted some Kellhounds mechs. And I was like, you know, I always thought I couldn't do this, but it turns out I can. And I went home and I painted some mechs with my kids, and then painted some more mechs. And then I played at Dragon Con at one point last year in September, and an Irby Derby, and had so much fun. I wanted to put one together locally, and I painted 12 Irbies in a night for that. And then now I think I've painted 30 mechs since then. So I'm just now I'm painting mechs, apparently.
It's fine. I mean, I am a lousy painter, by my own admission. I've had two cataracts. I have no depth perception. I don't have particularly steady hands. But I have found that the Catalyst minis in particular seem to take paint really well and really forgivingly. And they make me a halfway decent painter.
Yeah, no, it's I found that the Army Painter collaboration that they did, if you get the washes
and the speed paints.
Yeah, the speed paints, really, like, it's hard to screw them up, actually.
I mean, there's the technique that everyone seems to be swearing about at the moment, being slap chop, where you black undercoat and then dry brush and then put the speed paints on top, that gets you even more depth of shading. I reckon I can throw together a mech in about half an hour that will pass the 2-foot test on the tabletop, which is good enough for me in my eyesight. So
so I've been having a lot of fun painting, and I recently got a 3D printer and have been printing out terrain and stuff too, and I've just been having a lot of fun with it. It's been fun taking stuff from the tabletop and being able to apply it into the fiction too.
Oh yeah, I bet. So, favorite era?
Ilklan.
I thought you were going to say that.
You know, reading so much of the stuff beforehand, the Ilklan feels like, with one big exception, I have all the toys that I get to play with, right? Like, there's only one toy I don't get to play with, and that's Comstar.
True.
Right? I get to play with every other toy. There's really nothing else that's off the table.
Yep, I get that. Favorite faction?
Probably G.E. Chistu's Falcons.
I must admit, I am in, probably entirely due to some of your novels, starting to really enjoy them as a faction.
I mean, I want to say just the Jade Falcons generally, but I can't because of Malvina Hazen and what she did with them. That would be like saying, you know, I'm a really big fan of
genocide.
You know, genocide. Yeah, yeah, but
there's a degree to which GU's half the faction can't exist without Malvina.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's true.
You can't see the things that he's doing for what they are without what Malvina has been in the past.
Yeah. But I've had so much fun writing them and writing what they're doing and how they're doing it and how they're trying to make up for what Malvina had done and that identity crisis the Jade Falcons are going through. And I respond really well to that and making them underdogs, right? The Jade Falcons have been the heavy for so long in the fiction. Being able to write them as genuine underdogs who are literally hanging on by their fingernails has been so fun to see and to watch.
So favorite unit, and I don't mean miniature at this point, I mean force, so sort of Kellhounds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You are allowed to say Fox Patrol.
I think it's the Fox Patrol. I have so much fun writing them.
Mm-hmm.
They're just a lot of fun to write. When they asked me to do that Christmas story that came out, it just poured out so quickly because I hadn't written a Fox Patrol story in quite a while. And it was like going back and visiting old friends.
Yep.
And it came out in a day or two, and it was easy and it was fun. And I just laughed the whole way through.
Really, I confess I have not read that yet, but I've been trying to. So you left me a reading list with the Voidbreaker preview, which yeah. I've been trying to get through.
It's not mandatory. No. It's definitely. I tried to make Voidbreaker very new reader friendly, mm-hmm. but it's definitely those are the resources I drew upon when I was working on the book.
Cool. Favorite mech.
It sort of depends on the day. I would have said a Kit Fox before, but I've become frustrated with it because it's so hard to keep that damn thing alive.
I get that.
Like to write situations where Katie doesn't die every time she steps into it. But I would have to say the Marauder. I really like as an old school sort of Robotech fan. And sort of my professional experience with Robotech as well, and being, you know, watching Robotech as a 6 or 7 year old and having that imprinted on my brain, the Marauder is just a design that sort of crosses over all of sort of the geek circles in my brain that I love it. It's gorgeous.
And I think William Keith has a lot to answer for that, because he made. Very much made the Marauder a hero stroke villain mech in the original Grey Death Legion trilogy, and I think a lot of people picked up on that.
Yeah.
Okay, favorite novel, yours and then anyone else's?
I think right now my favorite novel of someone else's, it might be the one I've really attached to the most might be Ghost War. By Mike Stackpole, I think it's.
Yet.
Oh, really?
I'm currently trying to. I picked up BattleTech back about a couple of years ago, and I'm in there. Part of me is about 80 years behind with the lore reading novels,
uh-huh.
And then there's a chunk of me said I should start at the end of the Dark Age and get cracking because as a demo agent, I need to be running Ilclan stuff, and it's a fun era. So there's a big gap in the middle.
Yeah.
I'm slowly working through.
Ghost War is really Mike sort of at the height of his power as a writer, where his early stuff very much feels like early stuff. I know a lot of people will say, you got to start at the Warrior Trilogy. You got to start at the Invasion of the Clans and the Blood of Kerensky and stuff. And it's really great stuff, but it's definitely Mike at the beginning of his career. And Ghost War is sort of like him finally as a master of a craftsman, as a writer. And it really is sort of a very noir novel that sets the tone for what the Dark Age could be and its potential. And I really just responded to the noir vibe of it. It feels very much like sort of a remake of Red Harvest in a really great way. Of mine...
Put you on the spot.
Right now, I want to say one that I'll say Voidbreaker right now. Voidbreaker, I had so much fun with, and I really can't wait for people to read it.
It shows. I think you are absolutely forgiven the recency bias as well.
Yeah. Well, it's not so... I wrote it 2 years ago.
Really?
Yeah, I've written... 4 more BattleTech books since then.
Oh dear Lord!
Yeah,
we're not getting rid of you anytime soon, then.
Yeah,
Okay, favorite of the video games, since you're clearly a video gamer.
Oh, honestly, the Super Nintendo MechWarrior, that first one. That's I actually went through. I busted it back out when I first signed my contract to write Honor's Gauntlet. My first BattleTech novel, I busted it out again to play it again while I was writing. So I would write my words for the day and then go back and play it just to get some of that flavor. And I loved it. It is utter nonsense. It doesn't really match BattleTech. If I were to write a BattleTech book based on that game, fact check would have a field day with me. But it's so fun, and I really would like more games like that. Just very like I could play a game like that on my phone, no problem.
Well, yeah, with the power of modern phones, you certainly could, couldn't you?
Yeah, no, you really could. I mean, I could probably play it on my watch now.
Display, you know, might be a you bit know how small, they. But...
Yeah, the screen would be, but you know how they run Doom on everything. I bet they could do that with that MechWarrior game too.
I'm sure they could. So, last one, Kickstarter. Did you?
Oh yeah, no, I backed.
How badly?
Not as much as I wanted to, knowing that I would get some access to some of the stuff. The one thing I do regret not getting, though, is the big version of the universe book. I'm still sort of begging around trying to get a copy of it because I keep making the case, and I think this is actually a very valid case, that having all of the split cell like graphics in there that are the layered versions of like the elemental suits and the drop ships and the mechs and stuff would help me in the writing. So I've been trying to make a case that they need to just send me one for that.
So if you're listening, Catalyst, send Brian a copy.
Yeah. They know. Yeah, they know I've been asking for one. But that's the one big thing I regret getting. But I've been painting those mechs up, and it's been a lot of fun. And yeah, no, I backed. I didn't back it like a Kerensky level or anything, but no, I have been going to. I went to the last Kerensky Con, and that was a lot of fun. Just as a guest.
Yeah, I don't have the budget to back at that level. I went Battalion and it was expensive enough.
yeah, for sure.
Lovely. Right. So let's go back to you getting your feet wet in BattleTech. And I'm a little intrigued about the chronology of some of this, because you've got Honor's Gauntlet as your first novel. And roughly the same time, Fox Patrol starts appearing in Shrapnel. How did this all come about?
So, like I said, Mike had introduced me to the Catalyst folks. Mike had brought me on at Origins Game Fair, which is a convention that Gamma puts on, the Game Manufacturers Association. And Mike was an emeritus member of the board, and he was running the authors program there, and he had invited me. That he was the one who pushed me to publish my first novel because he wanted me to be a guest there. And so I had been a fixture of that program for a while, and Catalyst had been going to the show. And obviously Mike Stackpole being Mike Stackpole knew everyone there at Catalyst. And so I got to be friendly with those guys. And I had mentioned that I had been interested in writing Shadowrun because Shadowrun was also another seminal game in my youth, and John Helfer said, well, no, but I need BattleTech writers. Would you be interested in BattleTech? And that was around the time I had been working on the Robotech role-playing game, because Palladium had lost the license at that point after their Kickstarter situation, and a new company had picked it up, and I had been contracted to write all their lore sections and all their fiction for it, and their scenarios for it. And so it was like, well, this guy can handle mecha stuff. Maybe we should try him out, plus Mike's recommendation. And so I started reading up on the fiction. I asked Mike Stackpole where to start, and he's like, well, my stuff is really all you need. So I started, I said, well, which one? I don't know if you noticed this, but you've written a lot of BattleTech.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know, I still like those Blood of Kerensky books. Why don't you start there? So I started reading the first one of those, and I got about two chapters in, and I said, I have no idea what the hell's going on. And I know about BattleTech, right? I've played a bunch of the video games. So I backed up and went through the Grey Death Legion trilogy, and I was like, okay, this makes more sense.
They've always been a very good introduction to the setting, because they let you in fairly gently.
Very much so. And so, talking to John Helfers, they had a big hole in, you know, jihad era fiction. And so he wanted me to learn about that and really focus my time on that and make a bunch of pitches there. And that's what I was doing. And we talked about it a whole bunch back and forth. And the idea came up, like, as soon as we'd finally agreed on some jihad era stuff that I was going to do, the idea came up that John wanted to sort of build me up as one of the writers. And to do that, he wanted to team me up with Mike. And Mike was, I don't know, maybe hesitant to get back into BattleTech. I mean, it's not like Mike doesn't have any shortage of things to do, but Mike was willing to kind of come back and co-write some stuff with me because we're friends and that would be fun. And I think everyone was hesitant to bring the Kellhounds back without Mike being somehow directly involved. And so we were going to do a trilogy of Kellhounds stuff together where we were co-writing it. And so it would have both of our names on the cover, and it was going to culminate sort of with a tie-in with the events of the Battle of Terra, and it was going to have an alternate view of some of the events there and sort of tie in Hour of the Wolf. Obviously none of that happened as plans changed, and there was sort of there was a summit meeting that happened, I want to say fall 2019, that I was not privy to. Mm-hmm. And I didn't quite know what had happened, but Mike was there at that summit meeting, and I sort of get a call from Mike afterward. And Mike calls me afterward and said, well, the good news is you're on the schedule for a novel. The bad news is it's the first novel on the schedule and it needs to be done in 3 months. How much do you know about Jade Falcons? And I said, well, I haven't read any Jade Falcon novels yet because I've been studying the Kellhounds and the Jihad for all of this stuff that we've been doing. And he goes, well, start reading about them. Here's the brief of what your book needs to cover. And here's where it's set. They're going to start sending you a contract and stuff. So I had very little time to prepare for Honor's Gauntlet.
How tight was that brief? I mean, how much creative control do you get?
I was told that I needed to tell a story about the Jade Falcons emptying their occupation zone, and that the end of the book had to be them realizing that they were actually going to be coming to Terra. This was supposed to be the big reveal for the audience that the battle for Terra was coming, because Hour of the Wolf hadn't been announced yet. So this was going to be the big thing that told the audience, yes, we're actually moving the timeline forward. The Ilclan era is happening.
So Archer is yours at this point. He's your character at that point, or were you given Archer as a character?
No. So Archer, sort of. Mike sort of pitched me some sketches for ideas of what my story could possibly be. And I kind of put together, I Frankensteined a story together based on what interested me out of a few of the suggestions he made, and then added some stuff to myself and created a character named Diego Bailey. And through four drafts of that book, he was Diego Bailey. Mm-hmm. And then literally probably 3 weeks, maybe 6 weeks before publication, John Helfers came to me and said, hey, listen, we've got a Kickstarter character that's his background matches pretty much exactly with what you've written as Diego Bailey. Do you mind if we trade his name out? Because there's no way we're going to get a character this unique twice in the Jade Falcons. And I said, that's fine with me.
Let's hear it for search and replace.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we did. So you'll notice in Honor's Gauntlet, Diego Bailey, I'd really written him as sort of a pastiche of... He was really inspired and written as sort of Guy Williams's, like, he was patterned off of, like, in my head, I was writing him as Guy Williams. And he was, there was a lot of, like, Zorro panache to him. Right. So that's why he had that pencil-thin mustache. That's why he spoke a little Spanish. That's why his mech was named Toronado,
right,
which is Zorro's horse. And Diego was, you know, Diego de la Vega. And so a little bit of that got sanded off when we had to change his name to Archer instead of Diego.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was my character. And it was my story. And it was my, you know, Nikita Malthus was mine. She's
lovely in an unpleasant kind of way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was like...
I mean, she is sort of glorious, gloriously mustache-twirlingly bad.
Yeah. Well, it was me trying to create a proxy for Malvina, mm-hmm, because I couldn't use Malvina.
No, obviously not.
And it was just, how can I have Malvina feel like she's on the page without actually using her? So I'm just going to use someone who is doing an impersonation of Malvina.
It's clearly a Malvina wannabe in some ways.
Yeah, very much so.
And at the same time, you've got Katie popping up in Shrapnel. Was that just parallel evolution? Or?
So I had mentioned to John and Phil that I had an idea for another character that I'd really like to explore, and I kind of mentioned it in passing at a con, and they said, "Well, write up a pitch." And we'll tell you about it, and we'll let you know if we greenlight it. And my pitch was sort of based on, I really love sort of kids finding mechs, right? Like that Iron Giant sort of thing. And
that's what it reminded me of.
Yeah. One of my favorite things to do in that 93 Super Nintendo MechWarrior game was to not worry about my heat and not use a whole lot of missile-based weapons because they ran out of ammo too fast, and just load everything up with lasers and only take jobs that had lakes so I could go park myself in the water and just shoot at everything. And my idea was like, well, what if somebody had a mech like that, they overheated, they died, and then, you know, 50 years later, somebody dammed it up and the mech sort of faded under the water. And I had this image of a kid, you know, of Katie essentially taking a swim and going out and diving in the middle of this lake and finding a mech. And they were like, we really like the idea, but you can't have her go swim and find a mech. Absolutely not. You can't do that. And that was the last thing they ever said to me about it. And I was complaining to Mike one day, to Stackpole, and he's like, you're never going to hear back from them. And I'm like, why? It seems like a good idea. And he's like, they're busy and they've got 90 things on their plate. Just write it, send it to them. And I guarantee they'll publish it. It'll be fine. So without a contract or permission or anything, and Stackpole's sort of like, just do it. Just, you know, ask forgiveness, not permission. I wrote that first Katie story. Well, I wrote that one and the second one concurrently with Honor's Gauntlet, and I sent in Honor's Gauntlet, and while I was waiting to get their edits back, I sent Phil, who was editing Shrapnel, that first story as well, and he really loved it. And he just said, like, I can't publish another one until, you know, it has to come out every other issue. Mm-hmm. So every time an issue came out, I wrote the next three Fox Patrol stories, and just every time one came out, I'd send him the next one, even though I had all five of the next ones just sort of ready to go from that point forward.
So it's not quite the traditional I don't want to say rags to riches, but the traditional shrapnel author turns into BattleTech fiction writer story. But it's good motivation for those who want to give it a go.
Yeah, I mean,
did you basically go through the shrapnel process like everyone else at this point? Or do you get a little bit of an end around for being on the team already?
I did. Especially since Phil was one of the editors on Honor's Gauntlet.
Right.
So Phil and I had already had a working relationship, and, you know, he had been a resource for me in helping me sort of get my sea legs in the universe. So we were talking online all the time. And so it was something I sent directly to him. And it was before people were sending in a lot of stuff.
Right.
Like the slush pile was not as deep or as big as it is now.
It's dropped a bit, I'm told.
It has. Well, I mean, I'm one of the slush readers now. There are a lot of stories that come in every day. So people are sending in a lot of stuff.
I was quite surprised to learn that somebody I was talking to submitted the other day and was only 45 in the queue, which, given my first attempt, wound up in the 300s.
Well, yeah, there was definitely it's definitely gotten faster, but that was when the process was slower, and that was when there were fewer slush readers. So
while we're talking about it, then, what tips have you got for the folks like me who want to get into shrapnel?
I would say focus on being the best writer you can be and tell a great story. The BattleTech details matter a lot less than just telling a great story with great characters that can really hook a reader, because there's stuff that. Like, the details we can fix later. That's why there's a fact check team. There are definitely stories that I've read in the slush pile where I say, hey, I think these details are wrong, but the characters are so compelling and the story is so interesting. We could change the time period it's set in. We can change the factions, but this person really nails the characterization and the story. I think this would be worth working with them on. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You seem to be very much enjoying Fox Patrol as a sideline, almost.
Yeah.
Compared to that. The other thing that I did, well, there's a few things I wanted to comment on. One of the things I did notice is your author's voice for Katie and the Fox Patrol changes compared to the Honor's Gauntlet and the Question books. She has this delightfully optimistic, almost naive tone to the narration, which I'm assuming is perfectly deliberate.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. And hopefully it seems like the narration for Voidbreaker seems as different from
absolutely
that as the others, right? It is very much me trying to characterize the narration based on who's mm-hmm. telling the story and what point of view it is. Yeah. But yeah, Katie has this very naive, hyper-focused view of the world that is... very different.
And it's very endearing, actually. I think she comes over as a lovely character.
I think that's why a lot of people have sort of attached themselves to her mm-hmm. in a way where they see themselves a little bit like her. Like they just really love the mechs, and that's why they see themselves in her a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The war crimes and all the violence, that's fine, that's all secondary, but those mechs are really cool.
And I get to keep them and make them work better. She's very much a mech geek, isn't she?
Yeah.
Yes.
No, very much so.
Okay, and now, the ongoing novel that you had in 13 to 6, stretch from 13 to 16, the title, it is a nod to Lone Wolf and Cub, isn't it?
I mean, it is. It is, and I think in some ways... Katie's sort of the cub to the lone wolves.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, I tried to get away with naming Bugsy Heidegger's dropship, the Ogami Ito, which is the name of the lone wolf.
I spotted that.
It was supposed to get edited out in all the cases, and I had to change the name. But it didn't, in all of them. In the revisions, mm-hmm. when we collect it, it'll all get edited out. But yes, it is a reference to Lone Wolf and Cub. But all of the Fox Patrol stories have had Fox in the title somewhere and have yep. been some reference to some idiom or another. So that one felt like an easy... When I knew I was sending them on with the Lone Wolves, that felt like I had to do it.
Yeah, you kind of do, don't you? The other one that made yeah. me laugh like a drain because of what I do for a job is noting that 1,000 years later, the Indian diaspora still plays cricket.
Yeah.
I work for one of the big cricket stats companies.
Uh-huh.
So I got to the beginning of the first chapter of Lone Wolf and Fox and went, okay, right. Is that sort of the sum total of your knowledge of the game?
A little bit. I mean, like, I've tried to understand it a little better. Every time I go to Europe, I'm like, I've got to understand cricket better because it is, you know, the most popular game in the world, even though in America we have no idea what it is.
Well, if you ever make it over to UK in season, I'll take you to a game.
That would be fascinating. And like, I'm fascinated too. Like, my favorite episode of Bluey, one of my favorite episodes of Bluey is about cricket. and I mean, like, that's one thing. Actually, if you want to learn better storytelling, actually, Bluey is a great place to learn. To be honest, completely. Having to be in this science fiction mode and trying to think about what happens when all of these different cultures go out to the stars, it can't be so Western focused.
No.
Right? And thinking about Alina that was populated by Italians and Indians, where, like, what of those cultures are going to survive 1,000 years into the future? There's no way they're playing baseball. You know what I mean?
No, quite. Yeah, that's just, I said, it tickled me. As you say, it's nice to have sci-fi not be America moves to the stars, or even England moves to the stars.
Yeah, yeah. So I think a lot of the writers are trying to be more cognizant of that in a way that some of the writers in the 80s weren't necessarily, not because they weren't trying to be, but because it's so much easier to be now because we have the internet and mm-hmm. we have much more access to multiculturalism.
Indeed. So moving on to Honor's Gauntlet, there was one question I did want to make, which is what happens to Aaliyah and Callum? I mean, they're your characters, obviously, I assume. And Archer makes it to Terra and survives. What happens to the girls?
So I have plans for them if I get to write them again. Mm-hmm. But it was not necessarily my choice, or, you know, no one asked me. I was really tickled that Blaine was able to use Archer in any capacity in Hour of the Wolf and to see him at all on Terra. And if I'm able to pick up Archer's story at all, I would hope that they're able to be incorporated in that. But if anybody else gets to pick that up first, that would probably be their decision.
So did you get to know what happened to Archer before you read Hour of the Wolf, or did that just turn up in your inbox one day?
I was told that he was getting mentioned, and that was the extent of it.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah.
So, moving on to my Christmas reading. My wife and I gave up a long time ago trying to guess what each other wanted for Christmas. So we hand each other Amazon parcels and say, here, that's your Christmas present to me. And I got a question of survival without question, which lasted me all of Christmas Day. Is that another case of Catalyst giving you the end points and saying, go for it?
With a question of survival, it was a little bit more rigid. Question of survival was Ray Arastia, the line developer, pointing at the Coral event in Tamar Rising,
right?
Where GE says, I need to take these kids, and has the duel for it, and then said, We would really like you to write that story, but we would really like the book to end with the Ghost Bear Civil War starting with the vote and Alaric rejecting it.
Is that vote meant to feel like Brexit? Because it sure does from here.
I was really trying to draw on as much experience as I could from every close sort of tense election, whether that was Brexit or the 2000 election here in the US or close elections at the fall of the Roman Empire, mm-hmm. you know, like anything in that vein, right? History repeats itself and tense, close, hyper-partisan elections all kind of feel a lot alike.
People get, you know, set, I mean? Against each other who have otherwise perfectly friendly just because they happen to occupy different camps. Yeah, absolutely.
And so I've had folks from all corners of the globe actually tell me that it felt very much like their recent contentious local election.
Fair.
So I feel like it did its job without people being able to say like, oh, you were on this side or that, or I don't know. But yes, it was definitely a matter of Catalyst saying, here are the two things. Now, can you figure out a way to make that work dramatically? And so the two things I was able to add to that were, I had to add POV characters that did not exist in the source books who I felt had a compelling amount of drama and stakes in the story that we could hinge that on, because I knew a lot of folks, not all of them, but some of the folks would have read Tamar Rising and knew that GE would win the duel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I needed to have that. That's why Alexis was in this situation.
So that she has a stake in the story, which people are going to get involved with without, even if they've read Tamar Rising. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other one was that I needed to balance that out with someone who could have a parallel story in the Falcons. And that's why I created the Dawn character, where, so I created the boots on the ground character for both factions to show how those were working and to create stakes for what was going on for those characters, and really moving the story along that way and trying to create those character level stakes for people, because we'd already seen the faction level stakes in the source book.
Mm-hmm.
And then really getting to characterize G and Emilio Hall was Emilio had like four sentences in the source book, and his fate was not determined in the source book. So he was also something I leaned on, and that those were all things that I had sort of like created in order to try to make the book dramatic enough that people who had read the source book didn't feel like they were just reading an expansion of the source book.
Mm-hmm. Do you get a kick out of that? The taking the four lines and turning them into a character that still tells the story of those four lines in depth.
Oh yeah, no, it's a lot of fun. I really love the challenge of working in those situations where it's like, how can I make this work? And how can I make it work in a way that feels plausible? Or how can I fix it if it feels silly? Or how can I really improve upon it or make it dramatic in a way that it maybe people wouldn't have imagined? It feels like putting together the world's most complicated jigsaw puzzle.
It's that moment. I mean, I as a DM, I do this with world settings and putting things out. You just get that feeling when the pieces click together. You go, yes.
Oh yeah. 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 No, I definitely felt that when the scene came up. And spoilers, I guess, for anybody who hasn't read A Question of Survival, but it's been out for a few years. So, yeah. But the scene where Rand gets the message from Terra and confronts Hall, and they have that confrontation and Hall sort of meets his end.
Mm-hmm.
When I wrote that scene, that was the scene where I knew, like, oh, man, I think all the pieces fit finally.
Yeah.
And that's where I got that that biggest jolt of exhilaration there when I was writing.
And then we move on to Without Question, where now he's got his collection of fresh wet behind the ears new cadets.
He
has no choice but to use them.
Yeah. So that one, there was another book I was going to write, and then something happened to it on the schedule, and then there was a lot of demand for more GE, actually, and they're like, and I was like, well, I've got an idea for one, and Without Question was my pitch for that. And so I was like, I'd like to take them from the Battle of Sudeten and then really explore what it means to be a Jade Falcon in a post-Malvina world. And so this was my and how do they deal with that, and that was my pitch for that. So this was much more me on my own. And so the Battle of Sudeten was the last big thing in the source books, and so after that, that was the last, that first part of the book, after that I wasn't constrained by anything. That was just me charting new territory.
Mm-hmm.
And that felt really good too.
As a pair, they are, and I understand there's a third one coming at some point.
There are definitely, there's a pitch put together for another one. Where that falls on a timeline or a priority list, we will see. But there's definitely more coming. People seem to really like GE, and the more folks tell Catalyst they like GE and want more, will determine how much higher it raises on that priority
list. You heard it here, folks. I mean, I said, for finding that contrast to Malvina's half of the Jade Falcons, I know, because a lot of people, I think, in the clan, a lot of people who grew up in the clan invasion era, there, because of I Am Jade Falcon and all the others, have been quite fond of Jade Falcon. I think there's a degree to which, how can I put it, having them back has been a great. I mean, I'm seriously considering building a Jade Falcon force for the game for exactly this reason. And I think I have to say that if you're going to be playing Hinterlands mercenary stuff, they are definitely recommended reading, because they're a very good way of getting your head around what's going on, certainly in the general vicinity of Sudeten.
Yeah. No, the Hinterlands is such a fun area to play in generally. And it this book in particular, Without Question, gives you the mercenaries and the falcons and the horses, and different flavors of falcons too. And all of the chaos that's just happening, you know, in a microcosm on Sudeten. Mm-hmm. and other planets too. You know, the situation on Antares is
fluid.
You know, indicative of is indicative of what's going on as well with the Tomcats and everything.
Yeah, indeed. Also, who came up with the Lone Wolves? Because they're a brilliant idea.
So the Lone Wolves have been in the canon for a while, and it was something Rhea Rastia was having drinks with me at a convention. I want to say it was the weekend he proposed to me the idea for A Question of Survival and said, this is the next book we'd like you to write. And he said, have you thought about, what are your plans for the Fox Patrol? And I said, I've got them up to the point where I want to send them to the Inner Sphere and have them start doing bigger things, because I wanted them to start getting involved in bigger things in the Ilclan era, which is why I set them when I did, sort of intentionally from the beginning, that Katie would be in her mid-20s by the Ilclan era so that she could participate somehow in the periphery of the big events going on. And he said, have you thought about her joining up with the Lone Wolves? And I said, who are the Lone Wolves? And he said, well, go check them out in Tamar Rising. And you know, they were already in Tamar Rising, and they had a little bit of history on Sarna about how they'd been around for a while and they were just this co-op. So they've been around in the universe for a while. And as soon as that clicked, I realized that's when I pitched Lone Wolf and Fox, and I wrote that concurrently without question, and submitted that. I mean, that was done a year before it started hitting print. And it was on purpose, because I knew that if I got to write the Battle of Sudeten in Without Question, if that happened, I knew I was going to be able to tuck Katie in for a cameo.
She's always nice.
Yeah. And actually, I'll give a tease. When we collect, Lone Wolf and Fox, I wrote another 15,000 word sort of novella to collect with it that covers the entire Battle of Sudeten from Katie's POV.
Ooh, sweet.
Yeah. Which is really fun.
Yeah, that's good. Right. Moving on to the real reason we're here. I know it's taken us 55 minutes to get here, but Voidbreaker, you owe me a night's sleep.
I'm sorry.
You sent me the ARC, whenever it was, somewhere back about the 28th or 29th of December. I got to the end of, I think it was Honor's Gauntlet. No, it can't be, because Honor's Gauntlet was an audiobook. It might have been Hour of the Wolf, reading in bed. And I thought, I'll just start Voidbreaker. Boy, was that a mistake. 5:15 in the morning when I finished.
I really tried.
I absolutely loved it.
To make it readable, so it's great to hear that it kept you turning pages.
I thought the super glue on the covers was a bit unsporting, though. So give us the sales pitch.
So Voidbreaker is really, I hope, the true sort of capstone to the Dark Age era. It is a Ian Fleming-style spy thriller set in the BattleTech universe, where the Clancy Fox has set their best watch agent to abduct Tucker Harwell with the instructions to get the HPG network back up and running, no matter the cost. And that's what she aims to do, regardless of the fact that everyone and their cousin is out after Tucker Harwell as well.
Can't imagine why. It is. I really, really enjoy it. As I said, I just lay there, and fortunately, the wife was there on call. So make it finish. But I really enjoy this. There is a certain. I'm not going to spoil it too much, but to say I clocked the Fleming straight away. There is a plot twist from one of the Bond movies in it as well, isn't there?
Yeah, no, there's definitely, I mean, I'm a huge Bond fan, both of the novels and the movies. And that was sort of my take on it when we were at a creative summit in January 2023, when myself and a bunch of the writers and the line developers got together, and Ray Arastia, the line developer, sort of said, hey, this is a story we need. And he and I sort of went off to the corner of the room where one of the maps was laid out, and he was explaining to me how this needed to work for this particular story. And I said, this is a spy thriller. And he said, what do you mean? And I sort of pitched what became Voidbreaker. And I said, this is an Ian Fleming novel. Like, we need to do this like this. And he's like, I like that take. Pitch that. And it was supposed to be like this really quick, breezy Ian Fleming spy novel. And that's exactly what it turned into. And he really liked that take. And I think it was the right approach for this particular story. And I had so much fun writing it, because I went back and I reread all the Ian Fleming Bond novels, trying to analyze why they were so popular and so page turning, even when James Bond is just sitting there playing bridge, right? Trying to figure out why Hugo Drax is cheating, or how he's cheating, right? Like, you're reading page after page going, like, yeah, why is he cheating? How is he cheating? What, like, you're just reading compulsively because you want to know why, and trying to figure out how to apply those lessons learned into BattleTech was a really great experience. And I had so much fun figuring that out and still being able to incorporate the big mech battles.
Although it is, relatively speaking, quite mech light. It's almost more a Time of War or MechWarrior Destiny novel, isn't it, than a BattleTech novel, really.
A little bit. I mean, we did get the mech battles. Yeah. But it takes a bit to get to them, but they're there.
They're there. And it does wrap up a very important plot element, I think, which I kind of get the impression people have been crying out to get wrapped up one way or another.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it does. And I hope people are satisfied.
I'm trying not to spoil it.
Yeah. I hope people are satisfied with the answers that we get one way or the other, whether they're non-answers, whether they're the answers they want, whether they're the answers that they don't want, whether they don't get answers at all, whatever they get out of the book, I hope that it gives them enough closure that they feel satisfied.
And I think one of the nice things you've done there is it's a very human solution. It's not a wave of magic wand. Things still have to be done for things to happen. And
yeah.
If you need to leave places where it gets not done for plot reasons to somewhere, you can do it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's... I think the universe is going to... You know, the Inner Sphere is going to go through some changes. And they might not be fast, and they might not... Things aren't going to change overnight. And I think that's to the benefit of fans and the writers and everybody.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. And I said, I love the book. As currently I only have the ARC PDF, but I will be picking up a paper copy to go on the shelf with the others.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited for it to come out. This book is full of a lot of really big top level stuff and a lot of important stuff that people have been asking about for a long time. And I've been sitting on it for, you know, 2 years. So it's, you know, we discussed it in 2023. I wrote it in 2023, and it's finally coming out in 2025. So I'm just delighted that I get to like talk to people about it.
And here we are.
Yeah. Because it's been really hard.
It's one of those that you just want to say, look what I've done. It's awesome.
Yeah. No, it's,
yeah.
It's fun.
I, the other thing I like about it is it's still, despite it does pretty big things, it's still quite down at the personal character level.
Yeah, no, I think Kite Finn, or Kenja Rodriguez, who's the Sea Fox watch agent, is going through some things. She's definitely an interesting character. One of the things I've enjoyed exploring about this novel and the question books is how clan culture and clan members have been changing over 100 years of being exposed to the Inner Sphere. And with being a watch agent who spends a lot of time undercover and not being able to be a clanner, otherwise you're going to blow your cover, like, how does that change her perspective on things? And how does it change her ideas of what being a proper clanner is?
Her whole reaction to being, I'm out undercover, right, local food time.
Yeah, exactly. Things like that, right? Like, how does that change her perspective on things? They're really interesting things to explore. Like, how do you be true to being a clanner when you're told you've got to go blend in with the Inner Sphere? You've got to go act like one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you go train another clanner to go do that also? It's they're really interesting questions. How do they adapt when clanners aren't necessarily known for their skills at that?
Yeah, I like that that Petrichor is very much sort of trying to follow in those footsteps and figure out a place in the same problem.
Yeah. Yeah, and very much so.
You left that relationship dangling, I notice.
Yeah, yeah. And you'll notice, look for a cameo from her in the Hotspots Hinterlands book.
Oh, I only have my demo agent copy of that out, which I haven't really had time to sit down with because I've been doing the reading for this.
Yeah, yeah. No, she, Hotspots Hinterlands and Voidbreaker were sort of, being made in coordination. And so they asked me for some material and some characters and things. So there was some crossover.
Cool. That's out on the 24th. Yes.
Yes. The 24th. So, and hopefully paper copies will be available the same day. It might be a day or two after, but yes, it'll be available.
That's going to be Amazon to devour. Print on demand, yes.
Yeah.
And Kindle and all other reputable EPUB sources.
Indeed, indeed.
Go out and buy. There will be a link in the show notes, since I suspect it's probably already on Amazon for pre-order.
Mm-hmm. It is.
I thought it might be. And even in the UK as well, given my listeners are predominantly UK-based.
Yes.
Right. What's next for you in the Battletech writing world?
Are
you allowed to tell us?
I can... There are some things that have been announced. I just turned in... The most recent thing I've turned in is Mike Stackpole and I have turned in the first draft of the first... the script for the first graphic novel from the Kickstarter. So that should be really exciting. And Eldon Cowger is illustrating it. So I'm really excited. The preliminary work he's done with the characters and stuff looks terrific. So whenever they're allowed to show you all, I can't wait because it just looks great. I've got a Fox Patrol short novel that's written, without question, it leaves with the Lone Wolves and the Fox Patrol with them heading to Almatasin, which is the hiring hall that's one jump away from Sudeten. And so it documents the Fox Patrol's adventures there. And there is another book that's a little bit further out. And there is a serial novella series that I wrote that should start coming out this year about the Ghost Bear Civil War. So that's four interconnected novellas sort of before, during, and after the Civil War.
Right. You keep me busy then.
Yes. and we'll see what comes up after that. Because I'm sure they're not just going to... I'm sure I'm going to write more, so...
And I have to ask one last question, because when I read through your bio on your website, my eyes were drawn to Lost at the Con.
That was the book Mike pushed me to publish on my own.
As a season convention goer, I haven't been to Large Mythical Animal Con, but I suspect I know whereof you speak.
Yeah, yeah, no, it was really based.
Did you ever run across Bimbos of the Death Sun by Sherry McCrum?
No, I did not,
right.
Actually.
It's a, if memory serves, it's a university professor thrown into a science fiction convention who winds up dealing with a murder mystery.
That sounds fascinating.
And I thought, I've got to read Lost at the Con. So, it's entirely not Battletech. It's sitting on my Kindle waiting for me to have an evening spare time to dig in, but I have to say it just tickled me, being both a convention goer and having read Bimbos of the Death Sun. That was basically your first published fiction, even if it was self-published. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, that was the one that Mike sat me down and said, the reason agents and editors aren't picking this up is because they have no idea where the hell to put this on a shelf. you're going to all these conventions. You're going to sell this just fine on your own. And if you get it published by this date, I'll make you a guest at this convention. You can have a table. And it was my first convention as a professional author, and he sits me between him and Timothy Zahn.
Oh, nobody much then.
Yeah. So that was my first convention experience. And, you know, now I'm friends with Mike and Tim, and Aaron Alston was on the other table opposite, you know, Tim. And so, you know, they became, you know, Aaron became a great mentor and had me rewrite a whole bunch of books. And it was like the best experience ever, even though I wouldn't necessarily recommend self-publishing your first book. It worked out for me. But, yeah, it was that book. 'Cause Mike was just like, this book isn't going to work the way you think it's going to work. And he was right.
Yeah. I mean, he's, by then I'm assuming he's fairly experienced with the convention scene as well. So
yeah, he'd been around a few times.
Yes, I guess. Right. So, with that then, Voidbreaker out on the 24th of January on Amazon, on Kindle, should probably be out in print not long afterwards. Brian's other novels will be listed in the show notes, so you can go and make him a happy man and further your knowledge of the hinterlands and the Ilkline era in general, which I also strongly recommend because it's a really fun era of Battletech to be around for.
Oh, no, absolutely. Ilkline all the time.
Okay, absolutely. Right, this has been me, Mike Whittaker, and my guest, Brian Young. Thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you for having me. This has been tremendous.
You're very welcome.
So that's it for this episode. My thanks to Brian for being an excellent guest, and to Michael, who is CGL's social media manager, for setting up the interview and sourcing me an advance review copy of Voidbreaker. Back in episode 12, when I suspect you might get me and Bob back, and we're going to be talking about a few hobby-related things and beginning a series to get you caught up from 3055 to 3151. That'll be basically a little sort of half-hour look at a chunk of history that steps you forward a bit, and we'll be starting with the Second Star League and the expedition to the Clan Homeworlds. Which only remains, therefore, for me to say, as ever, have fun and roll good dice.
Tales from the Periphery is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 International License. In short, give us some credit, don't make money out of it, and if you make an adaptation of it, you must share it under the same license. Have fun!